So it's always a pleasure to invite you to listen along with me to my dear friend Jim Wilson, and it's always a pleasure and something of a task to know how to introduce someone who has been creative in so many realms, who has given so much of his life to creating ways for people to access the transcendent. And so maybe that's enough to say to get us started. Maybe he'll just be silent for the next hour and a half, yeah. given the topic tonight. But I doubt it. Knowing Jim for 35 years, I doubt it. So please join me in welcoming Jim Wilson. Thank you. Oh, by the way, he's also a librarian in himself, right here, with all these books.
Thank you, Rob. thank you for coming tonight on this. It's a beautiful July evening. Kind of like day was not too hot, so it's wonderful to be here. And I'd like to start with just a few minutes of silent contemplation. Something along 5 minutes. So begin. going to be a kind of a free-form talk tonight. If people have comments or questions, you know, like, please feel free to jump in. So when you're sitting in silence, one of the things I've observed that happens is the sonic realm becomes more prominent, you know, because the visual realm, either you're closing your eyes or you're the visual region is static, you know, like that the sonic realm continues to sort of flow, you know, like, and it isn't a matter of shifting one's focus, it just happens naturally, you know, like. And so what we hear are, you know, a car is passing, maybe someone's walking down the street, you know, like, or they're arising and they're appearing. And what I would like to suggest is that that's what's happening in our minds as well. It's the same thing. The mindscape and the sonicscape are very similar, you know, like, so. Thoughts and feelings are arising, you know, likes and dislikes are arising, and just like the sound of a car passing, and then they fall away, you know, like. And that's one of the ways of understanding how we can bring the kind of peacefulness that we get in our interaction with the world when we just sit down, and how we can bring it into the interior, is to treat what's going on in our minds with the same relaxed feeling as we treat the sounds and the soundscapes. So the mindscape, the soundscape can merge. Does that make sense, what I'm saying? Yeah. There's a wonderful haiku by Richard Wright. Are people familiar with Richard Wright? The author of Black Boy, Native Son. Yeah. So at the end of his life, he wrote haiku. You know, like, and his last work is a collection of haiku called This Other World. You know, like, and one of them is, in the still orchard, a petal falls to the grass, a bird stops singing. In the still orchard, a petal falls to the grass, a bird stops singing. So that's a wonderful allegory for the mind in meditation. You know, like, so you have this orchard, you know, the orchard is still, or it's the orchard of stillness. So that means no wind. Right? So, and then into that stillness, a petal falls, lands on the grass. So we know the season. The season is spring. You know, like, because it's an orchard, petals are falling. You know, like, that's how I visualize it. You know, like, and so the petal falls and enters into stillness. A bird stops singing. Now, he links these two statements by a semicolon, so I think the bird stops as the petal is falling. Now, that's my, you know, like, so you have a visual landscape, and you have a sonicscape, you know, like, so the bird stops singing and enters into silence. Like, so everything is settling into great silence. It's wonderful how he captured that sensation of everything kind of settling into that stillness. I think it's a really wonderful illustration of that. I like to go for a morning walk. I live in a rural area of the county, and so the road is pretty narrow. So, like, if two cars meet, one has to pull to the side, kind of thing. So I don't have to worry about cross traffic or anything like that. And I like to go walk in, like, the usually a little before sunrise. And I had this, I've had this experience several times where just as the sun comes over the horizon, the first rays, you know, hit, then everything becomes still. The birds stop singing. You know, like there's maybe 10 to 20 seconds, something like that. You know, like sometimes I've even noticed that the four-legged creatures will go, you know, like they'll kind of like look, you know, like and pause. It's really it's a wonderful experience. You know, but I feel like the whole world of nature is taking a pause and going into meditation. You know, like at that time. You know, it's just. It doesn't always happen, but it's happened often enough that I've noticed it. It doesn't happen if it's misty or overcast. You know, it has to be a clear day so the sunlight, you know, really hits. The biggest impact I've noticed is that the crows stop crying. You know, about that guy walking down the road. You know, like who's that? You know, like it's you know, warning everybody else about the so. I think contemplation is a very natural part of the world, you know. And when we're doing it, we're not doing something that's peculiar human or stressful or something that's artificial. You know, like in many ways, I think that we're actually entering into a pervasive domain that, because of the ways our lives are structured, we've kind of lost contact with it.
Can I just say something?
Yeah.
Years ago, I knew someone who traveled in a sailboat across the Pacific Ocean from Los Angeles to Tahiti, and he described that when in the middle of vast ocean happening, the sun would arise, that there was something like a crackling in the air. It's not quite the right word, but like something different, almost like it's a sound, but not exactly. So just what you were saying about all the creatures pausing, right. Like, oh, something else has arrived here. Not just visual,
right.
If something's shifted in the field.
Thank you.
I hadn't thought about this for a really long time.
I appreciate that.
Thank you for stimulating the memory.
Yeah. So this experience at sunrise, it's reminiscent of, in the Quaker tradition, going into that, they call it waiting worship, or the prayer of inward silence. So you enter into silence, and sometimes, there's no guarantee, but sometimes you experience the presence of what they call the inner light. You know, like there's a kind of inner sunrise, you know, like that happens. And that experience is formative for the Quaker tradition. You know, like, so there's that Quaker song, there's a light that is shining since the whole world began, there's a light that is shining in the heart of man, there's a light that is shining in the Turk and the Jew, there's a light that is shining in me and you. Walk in the light, you know, wherever you may be. Like, so that's the one of the core understandings of the Quaker tradition. Again, it's not guaranteed. You know, like sometimes you'll enter into inward silence and it's just boring. But that's all right. You know, that's not a problem. You know, like that. But when that happens, it's really, you know, very. It's a wonderful experience. You know, like it's really. Yeah, my own journey in spirituality has taken many twists and turns. And I started out in my 20s studying Zen under a Korean Zen master, and I eventually spent some time in Korea and Japan, and I became a monastic for about 6 years, you know, like, and I headed up a temple and that kind of thing. And so I had this this background, but I ended up in the Quaker tradition, and it's it's interesting how the experience of inward silence, the frame in which it is presented, or the vessel in which it is offered, can be meaningful to you. You know, like, so, there's a book on the table by Sarah Maitland called, I think it's called A Book of Silence. And she was very involved in politics and Episcopalian Church was having a lot of contentious issues at the time, and she was involved in that. And she found herself drawn to wanting more and more periods of solitude. Fortunately, she had some support. Her husband supported this, and some friends as well. You know, like, so. But many of her political friends really were got quite angry at these, you know, like this kind of withdrawal, you know, like. But she pursued it. It was like a using Quaker terms, it was a leading, you know, like. And there's an interesting section which spoke very much to me, where she was exploring different how different traditions offer silence. And so she was simultaneously going to a Zen group and a Quaker meeting. I don't mean she wasn't, you know, like projecting herself into two places at once, but but she was attending the Quaker meeting on Sunday and some other day of the week, a Zen group. And her observation was very interesting to me, and that is, she said, she described Quaker silence as porous. It's porous to the world, like, and that in the Zen tradition, and she wasn't saying this in any judgmental way, but it's more brittle. That is, you can break the silence, and that really resonated with me, you know, with my. I think she summed it up in a very interesting way, you know, like that. I was in charge of a temple at one point, and if people fidgeted or, heaven forbid, rose to speak, which is allowed at a Quaker meeting, it would have been my job to go and correct them, and I would have done it. Like, I would have, you know, like, either afterwards or right at the time, you know, I would have pulled them aside and said, that's inappropriate, you know, you shouldn't do that, you know, like, so there's a kind of, in the Quaker tradition, I found it more accepting and more relaxed, you know, like, which was very attractive to me.
When you were doing Zen practice, did you feel in some ways you were turning into a Quaker, but you were still in that form?
I wasn't very aware of the Quaker tradition at the time I was practicing Zen. The first time I went to a Quaker meeting was at the Brooklyn meeting. this was in like 1970-ish, something like that. And the Brooklyn meeting is a large meeting. It's been there a long time, you know, like, and the meeting is large. And I liked it very much. It happened that I was in transit at the time, you know, like, and I was, within a few months, I had left for California, you know, like, but I enjoyed it very much. But at that time, I didn't really compare it, you know, much to my Zen years and years of Zen practice. You know, like, so it was such a relief when I first walked into a Quaker meeting and they had chairs, so, and I no longer. When I first started practicing Zen, it was full lotus, and then, you know, maybe a decade later, it was half lotus, and then a few years later, it was Burmese, you know, like, and then it was kneeling with a bench, and then, so, our body gets a little more reluctant, you know, like, older. So, let's see. I discovered when I joined the Quaker meeting, and people who know me know I'm kind of voracious about tracking down sources and reading, you know, like I describe myself as inhaling books, but you know, like I discovered this manual of Quaker faith and in the Quaker tradition. This is a manual for the prayer of inward silence, as understood in the Quaker tradition. It was originally published in the early 19th century. A note to myself. And I found it to be really a wonderful work that I found very inspiring, you know, like, and spoke to me, you know, and to my past as well, you know, like, for example, we must retire from all outward objects and silence all the desires and wandering imaginations of the mind, that in this profound silence of the whole soul we may hearken to the ineffable voice of the divine teacher. We must listen with an attentive ear, for it is a still small voice. It is not indeed a voice uttered in words, as when a man speaks to his friend, but it is a perception infused by the secret operations and influences of the Divine Spirit. So in that passage, this guide to true peace tells you, really outlines the goal, you know, like, or the fruit of the practice, you know, like, and then at the end of this paragraph it says, the external word, even of the gospel, now remember this is in a Christian context, this was, the external word, even of the gospel, would be but an empty sound without this living and fruitful word in the interior to interpret it and open it to the understanding. Right? So, it's interesting about the Quaker tradition and its relationship to scripture, and that sums it up right there. You know, without this experience of inward silence and even more the inward light, the understanding of Holy Scripture will not be efficacious. You know, it will just give rise to yammering, like, and dispute and division. You know, without that experience, that's the key to opening and having a heart connection to those kinds of words. But that experience has to come first. You know, like, chapter 5 of the Guide to True Peace, it gives us the method. Chapter 5 is called the method for inward silence. And this is, using this method, you can become familiar with silence. You know, like, so it says, the sort of prayer to which we have alluded is that of inward silence, wherein the soul, abstracted from all outward things, in holy stillness, humble reverence, and lively faith, waits patiently to feel the divine presence and to receive the precious influences of the Holy Spirit. And when you retire for this purpose, which should be your frequent practice, you should consider yourself as being placed in the presence of God. So the basic practice is to think of yourself as being in the presence of the Holy, or of God. All right. So there's this actually is very close to many, like Brother Lawrence's, the practice of the presence of God. You know, like, it's very similar. You know, like, so the idea is, it's called waiting worship because the idea is that you're waiting for that presence. You're waiting for the sunrise.
That's
a wonderful analogy.
Yeah. Yeah, you're waiting for the sunrise. You can't manipulate it, you know, like, but you can wait for it. Yeah?
That was described in very Eucharistic terms. So it's interesting that they're playing off the Catholic idea of sacraments, but it's described as an inner experience, but yet the wording sounds very much like how the Eucharist is described in Catholic literature. It's that very last passage.
There's a book by a Quaker from Indiana. I'm trying to remember his name is Brent Bill. And I always get it reversed. I want to call him Bill Brent, but it's actually Brent Bell. Where he describes, it's a book about Quaker silence, and his main idea is that silence is the sacrament of the Quaker tradition. You know, that silence is sacramental, you know, like in the Quaker tradition. So I think that, Quakers themselves at times make that connection. They're like, the Quaker tradition is not a sacramental tradition. The early Quakers rejected both baptism and the sacrament of communion, which was very unusual at that time. And it caused them a great deal of trouble. it was not met favorably, their rejection. But they interpreted the sacraments as interior experiences. That was the true meaning of those rituals.
There's a wonderful quote by Nikola Tesla.
Uh-huh.
Of course, I can't remember it exactly, but basically he just said, "Be alone. That is when the great ideas come. Be alone."
Yeah. Thank you. So somebody, I can't remember who, somebody quoted, a friend of mine quoted Marianne Moore. She said, "The cure for loneliness is solitude."
I like it.
So this, your waiting worship is a very, I understood what Sarah Maitland was talking about, about Quaker silence is poorest to the world, because the analogy I often use is like I'm waiting in a train station for someone that I really want to meet, I'm eager to meet them, but I don't know exactly when the train is going to arrive. I know they're going to arrive on Tuesday, but, Tuesday morning, something like that. And so I'm there at the train station, and I might wander around, I might go to the newsstand, I might buy candy bar, but I don't allow myself to go too far. Because if I go too far, I'll miss the arrival of this presence that I want. The analogy isn't perfect because God is always present, and always existent, So it's really my own awareness and distractions which keep me from seeing the sunrise, but I think you get the idea. This analogy doesn't work anymore. I used to use it for Zen meditation, but it was like, it doesn't work anymore because airports have completely changed. But I used to say it was like being in an airport and you're holding a fistful of tickets, and they're all going to really interesting places, and you still don't get on any plane. You just let them come in and take off.
That would still work.
Huh?
That would still work.
But I think for those who are of my generation, it will work. But I have a feeling the younger generation, airports are, so tight now, if somebody, I don't think it would fit, because no one can be relaxed in an airport today. Chapter 5 continues, if while you are thus engaged, something of inward stillness or a degree of the softening influence of the divine spirit is mercifully granted you, you should prize these manifestations of the presence in your soul and be carefully and reverently attentive thereto. Be cautious, however, not to endeavor to increase them by your own activity. For by so doing, you will draw the mind off from that state of stillness and humble watchfulness, which you should be solicitous as much as possible to maintain. By fanning the flame, there is danger of extinguishing it, and thus depriving the soul of the nourishment that was intended for it. So it's kind of a subtle practice, you know, like, so the sun rises and you go, oh great, you know, like, let's get my iPhone out and take a picture. Yeah, and then you know, like, it's gone. You know, like, it's very interesting. You know, like, so, and there's a number of passages in the Guide to Peace about that. You know, like, there's a kind of a delicate state of mind, and that's part of becoming familiar with silence. You know, like, when you first have that kind of experience, because of our habits of mind, our tendency will be to want to capture it and sort of grab onto it. You know, like, and part of becoming familiar is sort of getting a footing about the state of mind that is restful and conducive to that presence. You know, like, so, and there is a learning curve about this. You know, there is, you know, like, it's perfectly natural for people to want to seize it or pin it down, or, you know, like, part of the frustration is there's a tendency to think, well, I had that experience, so I'm going to repeat exactly what I did before, and then it will happen, you know, again. And it doesn't work that way, you know, because the experience of that is you're entering into, I call it the presence of eternity. You know, like, and that which is eternal has a different kind of logic and a different, you know, it's not something you can enter into in a temporally causal way. I have found, for me, I think of that inner light that the Quakers refer to so often as the presence of eternity in the ephemeral individual. The presence of eternity in the ephemeral individual.
Are we a room full of ephemeral individuals?
We're a room full of ephemeral individuals in an ephemeral room. It does, doesn't it? Yes.
Was there ever a sense in the Quaker tradition of some of this is reminding me almost like the bridal mysticism that was practiced in the Catholic tradition?
Yeah.
Where you kind of used some imagery that reminded me, even though you're talking about the train station, but it also reminded me of, you know, the wise virgin and the foolish virgin waiting for the bridegroom. I'm wondering, did that language make it into the Quaker tradition?
Actually, it does. I'm trying to find the location. One moment, please. We can all enter into silence now while Jim is looking for the particular passage. There it is. Nope, that's a different one. It's at the end of a chapter. At the end of one of these chapters, it quotes what it refers to as an anonymous essay on devotion. In that essay, it uses two metaphors for this experience. And one of the metaphors is sexual union. I found it. God is the spirit, so is the mind. Bodies can have intercourse, so can souls. When minds are in an assimilating state of purity, they have union with their maker. This was the bliss of paradise. Sin interrupted, and holiness must restore it. To a soul thus distressed, the Creator communicates himself in a manner which is insensible to the natural eye, as the falling of dew. So this is the second metaphor. But not less refreshing in its secret powers than the dew is to vegetation. To me, this is a very rich passage because the two metaphors are so different. I mean, they are really different. Incidentally, because I'm the kind of, I decided I wanted to find out who wrote this anonymous essay on devotion, so I did a lot of research, and there was a Quaker by the name of Jesse Kersey who wrote a book on something like Basic Christian Doctrine, a very boring title, and it was published in the early 19th century, a little before the guide. And he quotes this. That's the earliest source that I found. And he attributes it to the London Review, December 1791. So I went online and I did some research on the London Review, and I actually found for $7 a 1791 edition of the London Review. And I got it, and I had to buy several issues. They wouldn't send me just one. And it's not there. I went to every page of the London Review, December 1791. Every line, and it's not there. So I thought, well, maybe you got the date wrong. So what about November? Not there. For one thing, there is not for the year 1791, there is not a single anonymous work. They're all authored. The London Review was a gentleman's magazine. There's travel essays, when I went to Greece, when I went to Egypt, how I spent my summer vacation in Somerset, things like that. And there's a lot about using English correctly, because gentlemen were very concerned with that. There's nothing like that in there. So I'm scratching my head. I have a number of hypotheses. One is that I think Jesse actually wrote it, but he was a little nervous, about putting it in this very traditional interpretation of Christianity. And so he wanted to attribute it to someone else. And since it was the London Review and he was an American, he could be pretty sure. So 200 years later, here's this guy in Sebastopol who tracks him down.
Could you read it again?
Sure. God is the spirit, so is the mind. Bodies can have intercourse, so can souls. When minds are in an assimilating state of purity, they have union with their maker. So the experience of interior silence is a form of union with the divine. This was the bliss of paradise, sin interrupted, and holiness must restore it. So if I were a Buddhist, I would, still a Buddhist, I would interpret that, that we have this inner clarity, and hindrances mar our ability to access that inner clarity. So in Buddhist terminology, the hindrances are called klesas. And klesas literally means cankers or sores, bodily sores. So the idea is you would remove those and enter into that condition. That's kind of a translation. I don't know if that's helpful, but to a soul that's distressed, the Creator communicates Himself. So why does the Creator communicate Himself to a distressed soul? Because God is love. So that is why. So if that is understood, then it makes complete, there's a light that is shining since the whole world began. There's a light that is shining in the heart of man. Everyone. That is the Quaker understanding, that every single human being, and I would extend it farther to all living beings, there is that divine light present and accessible through inward silence. And the reason it's present is it's a manifestation of love. So communicates Himself in a manner which is as insensible to the natural eye. So it's not, this light is not the light of the sun. It's insensible to the natural eye. As the falling of dew, but not less refreshing in its secret powers than the dew is to vegetation. The second metaphor speaks to This is a difficult topic, but Quakers and others who were speaking at that period, like the Continental Quietists, Madame Guyon, Miguel Molinos, the Pietists in Germany, their relationship to the divine is like vegetation to the dew, and that's a passive metaphor, and they actually would use the word passive.
It's like receptivity.
It's receptivity. It's like a plant receiving the light of the sun will grow. And all the plant has to do is receive that light. A plant will grow with the nourishment of rain, and all it has to do is receive that rain. Human beings are like a tree that is saying, no, I don't want that light. I'm gonna duck into the barn here, never mind the rain, I can do without that. It's really kind of annoying anyway,
I don't like getting wet.
So human beings are this passivity is very, it's subtle, and it's also problematic for our culture at this time. Howard Brinton, who was a early 20th century Quaker, published an edition to the guide in 1946. And he had a preface in there, and he said, the teaching of the guide is very difficult for modern people to understand because this is an age of activists. And we want, the idea that we should simply receive that gift is very hard. It's very difficult for us. It's probably has always been difficult for people, but I think there are, at this moment in time, there are special difficulties about it.
I just think, it's sort of hard to put into words, the sort of idea of the accomplished person, or the person who is effective in the world, or the person who is good at what they do, that cultivates a certain aspect of the human personality, that sort of, opposite of what you're talking about, in that it really gets in the way when what you want to do is to be open to the divine.
Thank you. So Robert Barclay wrote, he was an early Quaker. I can't remember when this was published. It was in roughly 1680, I think. And it's called An Apology for the True Christian Divinity. And it's very atypical of Quaker writing, but it's because it's written in the form, in the scholastic form of propositions, and counter-arguments and counter-counter-arguments, you know, which was the style of the time, the 17th century. That was very typical of that time. It's not typical of Quaker writing. In fact, it's kind of anomalous. You know, like, Quakers don't do theology. You know, like, what they do is the inner life. But
they do journals.
They do journals. Mm-hmm. The typical Quaker writing is the journal, epistle, you know, things like that. But having said that, this work has had a lot of influence in among Quakers. And he describes this experience. He's writing an auto commentary on his fifth and sixth propositions, which you don't need to know what those were. And he's disputing with other groups at the time. I'm just laying a foundation so you understand the kind of language he's using. You know, like he's disagreeing with Calvinists in particular. You know, like, so if two men have equal sufficient light and grace, and the one be saved by it and the other not, is it not because the one improves it, the other not? So the Calvinists and the Arminians and others would say it's because of the effort they made that one got saved and the other did not. You know, like, so is not then the will of man the cause of one's salvation? No. I say, to such we thus answer, that as the grace and light in all, is sufficient to save all, and of its own nature would save all, so it strives and wrestles with all for to save them. He that resists its striving is the cause of his own condemnation. He that resists it not, it becomes his salvation. So that in him that is saved, the working is of grace and not of the man. And it is a passiveness. He actually used the word passive. Like so. So that the first step is not by our working, but by our not contrary working. So the language is of the time, but does it make sense what he's saying here? You know, like this. So you can work contrary to the light if you want to. You can, the tree can duck into the barn and say, "I've had it with light." You know, like, enough of that. You know, like, and human beings often do that. You know, like,
I was struck in the quote you cited earlier as an example of the receptivity and the passiveness that the words were about the dew on the grass.
Yes.
It's not about rain.
Yes.
It's much more subtle.
Right.
It's much less obvious that there's something that's really beneficial happening here. It's the subtlety of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And the delicateness of that. Of what one is being receptive to.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
What you were just saying reminded me of something I heard recently. An anecdote of a man who went to one of those mountain tops to see a guru. And when he finally got there, he said, "You know, I want to have what you have. I want to be like you. How long will it take me if I do what you're doing?" And the guru said, 10 years. He said, "But what if I work really, really, really hard at it?" And he said, 20 years.
Thank you. That's great. So, one of the things I love about the Quaker tradition is that it's very, this type of work, the guide, and there's references scattered to the prayer of inward silence, they're very aware of human, I want to use the word limitations, but that's not quite the word that I'm looking for. The realities, yeah, of being human. You know, like, so the guy, for example, has a whole chapter about dryness. You know, like, when you go through a period, you know, like, you've had the experience of the inner light, and then you doubt. You know, like, and you doubt, and you doubt, and you doubt. You know, like, and what's that about? And how to negotiate that? And how to, you know, like, how to keep practicing even in the midst of that? There's the Latin word for that is assedia. You know, like, and there's a great deal written about that. You know, like, but my own feeling about that, from my own experience, I have had periods, extended periods of dryness in my contemplation, is that when I come out the other side of that period, what I notice is that there has been a transformation taking place, but it's not a transformation that I can notice with my analytical mind.
And you didn't recognize
it. I didn't recognize it. Other people might have recognized it. And looking back, I can sometimes recall people saying, oh, you used to be this way, but now, or, you know, like, I see that that doesn't bother you anymore, or something like that. But it didn't register to me, you know, like, at the time. You know, like, so these kinds of transformations can be happening at, it's not even, it's deeper than subconscious. It could be happening at the level of bodily energy, you know, like, and we don't see it, you know, like, and, but if we stick with it, we will, you know, like, I mean, I'm speaking from my personal experience and my own journey, you know, but it is a tough one. It's kind of like when you practice to be a musician, you know, like, and you reach a certain plateau, you know, like, and you don't seem to be getting better, you know, like, and you're practicing, you know, like, but it doesn't seem to be, you know, like, you seem, you can't do more difficult pieces, or, you know, it doesn't, it isn't flowing the way you want it to flow. And what's interesting about that is often your music teacher can see that things are developing. You can't see it, you can't hear it, you know, but the your music teacher, you know, can register that there are, in fact, certain changes going on, but they aren't big changes or obvious changes. So this kind of path is a meandering path. It's not a highway. You know, like, it's like a path through the woods where sometimes you go into the shade, you know, like, for a while. You know, like, and I think it's good to know that ahead of time. You know, like, so that you aren't, like, so that you don't go, like, into a depression about it or something, or you feel that you've lost it, you know, lost that touch or that experience, you know, like, it's, and that's one of the things that the Quakers were very aware of that, you know, like, and they write about that, and they're very solicitous, you know, of, to people. There's, over and over again, they talk about there's no guarantee that you will have that experience. You know, when you enter into this, there's, you can't, like I said before, you can't manipulate that experience or coerce the light. It doesn't work to go to a tanning salon, a spiritual tanning salon. Oh, this is, and then we'll do that.
Does it have anything to do with surrender?
Yes. Yeah, it does. And sometimes we're not surrendering to the presence of the light in ways that we don't recognize. You know, like, so. And it sometimes takes a lot of time to see what we're doing.
One of the things I used to say to myself when I stepped over the threshold of the meeting house was, I want to be open to what's here.
Right.
Which means I don't have an agenda.
Right. So the guy talks about, so entering into interior silence, the way you do that is you place yourself in the presence of the divine, you know, the divine presence. And then you accept whatever is offered. All right. So if the sun appears, that's what's offered. And if your mind is chattering a mile a minute, that's what's offered. You know, like, and you, and this acceptance is very transformative. You know, like, in itself, it's a powerful practice. You know, like, there's a Catholic writer by the name of De Caussade who wrote a book called The Abandonment to Divine Providence. And his whole practice was acceptance of whatever whatever is what is, you know, like, and to like to fully accept that, you know, like, but that's not easy to do, you know. There are ways of bringing the practice, returning to the theme of becoming familiar with silence. I just want to give a few specific recommendations. You know, the guide says, and this should be your frequent, you know, you should do this frequently. This guide used to be in the hands of every Quaker for like a century. You know, like, and it's very interesting. You know, like, so my experience is that you can begin carrying this kind of practice into your everyday life. And the way you do it is you create a kind of a short trigger to place yourself in the presence of the divine. And usually it's just like a short reminder, a word, a brief word. You know, like, I use Deo Gratias. You know, like, which means thanks be to God. You know, like, some people use Kyrie Eleison. Some people, you might want to just use the word presence. You know, like, but if you're waiting in line at a store, if you're, it's a very safe practice. It won't distract you. You know, like, if you're on a break, just do that. It's a way of framing. You know, it's a way of moving the mind into that spaciousness of inward silence. Like, and I found it to be a very, very effective way of bringing that presence with me wherever I go, you know, at any time, at any place. It's also a very good way of starting your contemplation at home. You know, like, many people like to start a period of contemplation with a psalm, you know. Hey, but you don't have to read the whole psalm. You can just start, "The Lord is my shepherd." That's enough. You know, like, and so when your group meetings are excellent, but whether you're in a group or whether you're doing it alone, you'll find that you have in fact gotten on a train at the station. You're miles and miles away. This kind of reminder, this word, you know, it could be peace or presence, or gets you off the train and back at the station. You know, like, another technique which a lot of you may be familiar with is the breath. I'm not talking about manipulating the breath. I'm talking about simply taking a breath. You know, so you realize, you know, you've wandered off, you're far away from the station, you can just go, you know, and bring yourself back. It's a wonderful way, this short word, this short trigger, this short reminder. It could be, you know, a word like compassion or love, whatever resonates with you. For many years, I did Kyrie Eleison, and I actually switched, you know, like, at one point. So I don't think you have to stick, you know, with one word, all the time. But it is a way of becoming familiar with silence wherever you are. You know, like, so that it isn't confined to just an hour a week, you know, like, or a half hour a week. There's a section in there about, in the Guide to True Peace, about that through this kind of practice, that this kind of practice should not be confined to just a half hour or an hour. You know, like, it should be brought into your whole life wherever you go. And in closing, I'd like to say that the Guide to True Peace has helped me to understand the origin of the Quaker commitment to peace in the world. You know, like, so what is called in the Quaker tradition the peace witness, or also called the peace testimony. You know, like, that when we have that peace within, that is the origin, you know, like, and we have that experience of inner light, which is the presence of love, you know, like, then that very naturally results in having in a commitment to that peace in the world at large. So, you know, like, many of the early Quakers spoke about this connection, but I really didn't get it, you know, for quite a while. You know, like, that there really is a link between this experience of inner peace and the Quaker commitment to outward peace. The early Quakers were that commitment to outward peace wasn't just a political commitment. Yeah, I mean, it was a political commitment, but it wasn't just a political commitment, only a political commitment. It grew out of that experience of inner peace. So I started out talking about how the sonic realm, you know, how sounds rise and fall away, and the inner realm of the mind, ideas and feelings arise and fall away. And now the flow reverses. The experience of the inner stillness and the light that arises in that stillness flows out of us into the world and is the source of peace. The source of peace in the world. So, like, George Fox wrote a letter, famous letter, to Charles II. I think it was Charles II. That we will, we the people, I'm paraphrasing, the people called Quakers, you know, like, will not defend themselves with carnal weapons. You know, like, they will not defend themselves, they will not defend the nation, and they will not defend their religion, you know, like, using muskets and spears and that kind of thing. You know, like, and that is their vision and their view of how they should be present in the world. And it's my view that that understanding arose from that inward experience of true peace. Like, so, my final offering will be, I opened with a poem, so I thought I would close with a poem. This is from my collection, Even in Winter. Time, slow, sunlight, afternoon, February, a clear, cloudless sky. The air is cold and dry. I am at peace in my room, in my silent hermitage. I sense the presence of God. The gentle touch of timelessness is so much more than I can grasp. I become inarticulate. A coyote briefly trots by. A satellite is launched into space. Saturn is slowly turning direct. In Andromeda, a new star is born. A sparrow appears on the windowsill. A new Buddhist nun has her long hair shorn. An ocean wave becomes perfectly still. Mm. Thank you.
Nice.
So, I want to thank you all for coming tonight. I want to point out, I was wrong, it's not all Jim. He's not the sole source of the library, but let's say he's got the lion's share.
I'm well represented.
The lion's share of his own work, but also, of course, works relevant, some of which he has read or quoted from tonight over there as well. And we have a donation bowl over on the counter, and we encourage you to contribute to it and encourage you to support speakers such as Jim and also this space where we have speakers such as Jim. So thank you all for coming tonight, and come back for one of our future events. And when the shelves are around, you can come and see all of our cool stuff. Thank you so much.
And there is a Quaker meeting here on Sundays at 9:30.
There you go.
All right.
Put that in there. Right here.